As promised on several previous shows, I'm going to be joined in this segment by Dr. Whitney Lehman of UC Davis to talk a little bit about genetic engineering. Welcome back, Whitney.
Thanks for having me again. I got my degree from UC Davis, but actually I'm not associated with the university anymore.
Oh, okay. Well, okay.
They'll probably be unhappy if you try to associate me with them.
They will not. But anyway, okay. Fair enough. We know where you got your degree.
All right.
We need to actually replay for our listening audience something that should have aired last week but got a little bit mixed up in the transition. We promised you at the beginning of last week's program that we would have on the show Dr. Ignacio Chiappella. Well, a funny thing happened on the way to his appearance on our show, which we'll tell you about in a little bit. But let's take up where we left off and air the segment that did not get aired last week regarding the matter of bioengineered foods. Dr. Chiappella has been a critic of the partnerships that have sprung up between universities and corporations. In 1998, he led a fight against a controversial research partnership between the biotech firm Novartis and UC Berkeley. Now, one thing that's come out of my study of this this subject matter in regards to our ongoing expo in Sacramento is that, like the concentration of power in the hands of a few corporations, which we talked about as regards the American media a couple of weeks back, five companies seem to truly dominate genetic engineering technology. Those are Dow, DuPont, Syngenta, Aventis, and Monsanto. Dr. Chiappella has truly been at the center of a firestorm of controversy over work he did with a graduate student in Oaxaca, Mexico, that we will return to in a few minutes. We refer you to a good article in The Nation magazine, which appeared on October 28, 2002, which explained that in the past 6 years, 34% of our corn, 75% of our soybean, 70% of our cotton, and 15% of our canola is genetically engineered. Present also at Ann Veneman's Agricultural Expo in Sacramento was a group called the International Forum on Globalization, which I exchanged cards with, and hopefully they'll be able to talk to us at some point in the future. They put out a fact sheet on the corporate consolidation of industrial agriculture that I thought was pretty interesting. I want to quote a couple items on it. 91% of all genetically modified crops grown worldwide in 2001 were from Monsanto seeds. Only 1% of genetically modified research is aimed at crops used by poor farmers in poorer countries. Six corporations based in the U.S. and Europe controlled 98% of the market for GM crops and 70% of the world's pesticide market in 2000. According to the Center for Food Safety of the International Forum on Globalization, seven top agricultural biotech companies rank as the world's top seven agrochemical corporations. These seven gene giants also rank among the world's top 10 seed corporations. Now, currently on your newsstands is the summer edition of Invention and Technology. On page 16, an excellent article, flows forth called The Growth of Genetically Modified Foods. Now, it's very interesting that the history of genetically modified organisms and UC Davis appear to be quite intertwined. In the early 90s, a company called Calgene, which was one of the first startup companies in the field, built offices and research labs near UCD. Advanced work there was done under the leadership of Roger Salquist, who was Calgene's CEO. To give you a very abbreviated version of the story, it was believed by Calgene they could produce what was called the Flavor Saver tomato, one which would be deactivated in making a couple of enzymes which would keep the tomato firm while it ripened. It was a good tomato, a flavorful fruit, and one that was experiencing some marketing success when it ran into people who were worried about issues regarding genetic modification. Calgene managed to sort of stay afloat for a while in the 90s, but by 1996, the company sold out to Monsanto. Now, Monsanto had no intention of entering the grocery business. Rather, it prized Calgene's broad patent on using antisense genes, which is basically the mechanism by which the flavor saver was created. But Monsanto saw it applying not only to tomatoes, but to gene-spliced food plants in general. This meant that anyone who wanted to use this anti-sense approach in the technology to cancel the workings of a gene in a plant would have to pay royalties or licensing fees to Monsanto. Now, Monsanto was a major producer of Roundup and other herbicides. They saw this as an opportunity to boost sales of these products. Roundup works by disrupting the action of an enzyme that is found in plants but not in humans. Their bright idea was put Roundup resistance into crops and then sell more Roundup to kill the weeds. And this is now being done in a very big way. Now, we've been meaning for some time to bring Dr. Whitney Lehman back onto the program to discuss this book, this national bestseller, The Botany of Desire. Michael Pollan, the author, tells a story, which is also talked about in Invention and Technology, about what is being done with a toxin produced by a common soil bacterium, Bacillus thuringiensis. Now, this BT toxin has provided a low-tech way for organic farmers to put this bacterium onto a crop and then protect it from insect predators. But Monsanto got the idea of taking the gene that makes the toxin and inserting it right into the plant. Now, Monsanto admits that using this high-tech approach will produce large numbers of plants that have a certain resistance to insect predation, but that, of course, as always will happen, the bugs will get smart and learn how to beat this toxin. What this will do is then ruin the system of using this bacterium for organic farmers and everyone else. Monsanto isn't worried about it. They say, trust us, 30 years from now, we'll have something else in the pipeline. This should make you nervous because without really knowing what we're doing, we're introducing poisons in certain plants which will build up in the environment in ways we're not sure about. We'll also be inducing herbicide resistance into plants that may then jump ship into weeds, creating super weeds. This isn't just a theoretical concern. We've already found that, for example, commercially produced beets that were transgenetic had those newly inserted genes jump ship into wild beets. When Dr. Chappella found transgenetic evidence of high-tech corn having jumped ship into Oaxaca, Mexico, he was roundly criticized. But now it appears he's been vindicated. Everyone admits, yes, it's there. The USDA hasn't been concerned about this very much until Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich fought the biotech industry. He doubled, in effect, the amount of money that was being spent by the USDA on research on risk assessment. It went from 1% of their budget to 2%. The Nation magazine contains a very scary anecdote as well, describing an organic farmer in Iowa, Laura Krause. Krause is one of Iowa's 500 organic farmers. She has to certify every year that her plants do not contain genetically modified genes. When she went to test them in February of 2002, she discovered they, in fact, did contain genetically modified genes. Apparently, Monsanto's variety of BT corn, which is widely grown in the area, cross-pollinated with her crop and introduced genetic modification into what had been an organic farm. She lost her organic certification, and the price she received for her corn dropped in half. So like the farmers in Oaxaca, Mexico, like it or not, you've got trans genes in your corn. Now, this is in a legal limbo. Monsanto and other companies retain the legal rights to enforce their patent holder prerogatives, but there's no legal means for farmers to enforce the purity of their varieties. Now, we don't have enough time to really go into much more of this today, but we will be returning to this subject, I promise you. Genetic modification is not all bad, that's for sure. When I started into medical school, there was no such thing as human insulin available for diabetics. You used pork insulin or beef insulin extracted from the pancreases of animals taken to slaughter. Thanks to genetic engineering, you can now get pure human insulin, which is different than pork or beef, which works as it's supposed to in the human body. It's been a huge boon to mankind and shows the promise of the technology. But keep in mind, this is a far cry from what we're talking about with Monsanto and the use of Roundup resistance. All right. I'm glad to have gotten that aired finally and to update what happened last week. Dr. Chappella said he would be glad to come on our show, but it turned out that very night, last Thursday, he was engaged in planning a five-day teach-in to be held at the Berkeley campus. He faced, as of last Thursday, the fact that the Monday deadline, which was going to be the 30th of June, deadline was looming for him and that he would then have no contract at UC Berkeley. Now, of course, he's very controversial. There's been this issue we mentioned of his being possibly denied tenure. He then set out to spend five straight days on the Berkeley campus. I went to go visit him on Sunday and had quite a lengthy chat. He will be happy to appear on this program when he gets back from a trip to Norway later in the month of July. And at that point, we will go into his story at some length. I must say it was very interesting being on the Berkeley campus and seeing a professor with his chair and library and snacks and coffee cups sitting out under a tree resembling Socrates, I think, in ancient Athens as the students were coming by. And there was quite a lot of support. As it turned out, the university, within a half an hour of him setting out the chair to begin this five-day marathon, the university granted him a one-year extension on his contract. The issue of tenure is still up in the air, but he won't be going anywhere soon. So we'll be returning to that story, and I'm sure we'll have a very interesting talk at that time with Dr. Ignacio Chappella. Now, back to you, Dr. Lehman, and let's go live here to talk about this fabulous book, which I know you've just read, The Botany of Desire, and this whole issue. How would you frame the question?
Well, I guess we could maybe start by asking whether genetically engineered microorganisms or other genetically modified species are really necessary, I guess. And you had said before that there are some useful applications, and I'd have to agree, although I generally don't like the idea of genetically engineering life. There are some useful things that can be done with it. You know, for instance, I'm a vegetarian, and so I think it's great that they can genetically engineer rennet. Now, it doesn't have to be obtained from calves' stomachs.
Actually, I was reading, actually, it's the majority of rennet now in this country. The majority of the cheese, cottage cheese, dairy products that you buy that are exposed to rennet, they do use genetically modified rennet.
Yeah, actually, I think a lot of places now, I'm thankful of this, in California use rennet derived from plants, and it's not genetically modified. It's just a different type of coagulant. I think they still call it rennet. I'm not really sure why they do that.
But, really?
Yeah.
There's a plant that mimics the action of calves' stomach?
Oh, I'm sure there's coagulants found all over nature. Lemon juice, of course, is a coagulant. It's just weaker, I suppose, than rennet, which is probably why they use it commercially.
Darned.
But no, there are other coagulants you can use. And I would like to see someday, perhaps, you know, genetically engineered muscle instead of having to slaughter animals. Of course, we've been through the whole slaughterhouse discussion before. It's a fairly cruel thing.
Well, that would give you the option. If there's a muscle, a protein that's lacking in plants, you could just program it into the plant, potentially.
Yes. Possibly, yeah, or even, who knows, maybe even make it in a lab and grown in some sort of medium. I'm not really sure.
We should probably cite the third success story people point to in terms of genetic engineering, besides human insulin and rennet that doesn't come from a calf's stomach. There's also growth hormone, which used to have to be extracted from human pituitaries in a very painstaking fashion, subject to contamination, subject to viruses, diseases, and now they can give you... It's a limited application, although it's now, of course, being abused by people in Hollywood and other places. But growth hormone is, you know, something that is another success story to genetic engineering.
Yeah, and what we're talking about here, these are pretty controlled applications. You know, this is not something that hopefully wouldn't escape from the lab and be introduced into nature. When you're talking about farming, you know, the subject of Michael Pollan's book, then you're talking about an open system, something with the ability to cross-pollinate. You had mentioned transgenic species. And, of course, that's a possibility in an open system, something that's not controlled. And I guess that's what the fear is. I mean, is this really necessary? If we're to the point in our evolution that we don't have enough food, that we can't raise enough food conventionally to feed the people on the planet, then I would think that would be a sign to us that perhaps we're doing something wrong, and maybe we could try to take other measures such as population control rather than genetically modifying our food, which could have potentially very serious effects down the road.
Well, this ag conference touted the notion that it would be very useful to third world nations to solve the problems of hunger, but most critics pointed out that was a very weak argument, and in fact, very little technology is actually going in that direction.
Right.
All right, well then, Whitney, shall we talk a bit about Michael Pollan's excellent book? He's got a chapter on apples, a chapter on tulips, a chapter on marijuana, which I would like you to come back and talk about in a future installment of this program.
Yes, that was an interesting chapter.
Yes, it was. And the one that I think we should talk about today, potatoes, because he addressed this issue of the genetically modified potato at great length.
Yes.
All right, well, I think it was the New Leaf potato, again, from the ubiquitous Monsanto Corporation that was a subject of much controversy in Pollan's chapter. Can we just set the stage here maybe for the listener about what he was describing there, the difference between the organic farmer up in Idaho, of course, potato country, growing his potatoes, not using pesticides, versus this high-tech approach?
Mm-hmm. Well, at least the organic farmer employed some sort of biodiversity, and I think that's one of the major issues Michael Pollan raises is when you're starting to grow these clones, monocultures of potatoes or corn, not necessarily one small thing, but something that comes along like a blight, for example, the potato famine in Ireland, could knock out the entire crop. Potentially, it would be disastrous. Rather than an organic farmer like the person in Idaho growing a number of potatoes, he didn't put all of his eggs in one basket for any growing season. In case something came along and got one crop, he had other ones he could rely on. Plus, he used an integrated kind of holistic system of pest management rather than genetically engineered crops that have a toxin in them which kills beetles and other insects. Actually, the pollen can kill, I think it's caterpillar larvae.
Now let's return to the toxin in a minute. It's amazing to have this classic example of history of the Irish potato famine. Ireland had 8 million people on that little island in the 1830s largely because potatoes were so bloody easy to grow. And yet, some blight managed to solve the problem of how to wipe out potatoes, and because potatoes had been all grown together and there was not much diversity, there was no potatoes all of a sudden, and people had nothing to eat.
Right.
And yet here we are, setting ourselves up for a 21st century repeat of that idea, because these people that are growing potatoes, they're using say you want to get a McDonald's fry. A good McDonald's fry, they say, takes the Luther Burbank strain of the russet potato. Mm-hmm. And basically, you've got all these identical twins out there.
Yes. They taste good or look nice, but do we really want to be eating BT toxin, number one? And then number two, certainly the lack of diversity means that they're more prone to something bad happening, whereas, you know, a diverse ecosystem, there's a number of species that can take over in case something happens to one of them.
So all your plants are the same, when one insect pest gets a toehold, then all of a sudden you've got to use pesticide in a big way to save the crop.
That's right.
There's that aspect of it, but let's get back to BT. We talked about it in the segment from last week.
I've never heard that it's been proven that BT is absolutely safe, and that's an interesting thing that the federal government allows things like BT in potatoes. They don't require a label, and they're assumed to be no different than regular potatoes, but I've never seen any hard and fast proof of that they are exactly the same or substantially the same.
It's been a while since I read the book, but as I recall, Pollan describes planting a little part of it in his vegetable garden and watching the Colorado potato beetle come, chew on the leaves, and
die. Keel
over.
That's right.
No pesticides, eats the leaves, kaboom.
Right. That doesn't seem entirely healthy for human beings. And
it does make you wonder, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And you wonder, supposedly BT, when it's sprayed on crops, doesn't last long in the environment. It doesn't hang around very long. It's degraded quickly, naturally. But
good point.
In the plant and in the pollen and in the potato itself, yes, it seems to linger.
In every cell of the potato.
That's right.
You've
every cell
got
of the potato.
You've got the toxin. There's no way. You're
that's
not
right.
Programming it to make, you know, the leaves and or whatever. No, it's the everything in it has this poison, unlike an organic farmer.
That's right. And I worked in a lab at Davis, and they were fiddling around with inserting scorpion toxin into tomatoes, because tomato plants are plagued in California by these caterpillars that cause a lot of crop damage.
They were putting scorpion toxin
into tomatoes, yes, genetically engineering them into the plant. So,
And
that's another thing you have to wonder. Is scorpion toxin very good for you? Probably not, since scorpions can probably kill you, or at least make you very sick if they bite you.
Once it's in the tomato, your salad's going to get scorpion toxin.
I would assume, unless there is some way that as the tomato ripens or after it's picked, if you let it sit for some amount of time, maybe the amount of toxin degrades. I don't know, but it doesn't seem like a good thing.
I would doubt that.
Yeah, I don't know. But it doesn't seem particularly healthy. I wouldn't want to eat one. And I would certainly want to know, if I saw those tomatoes in this grocery store, I would want to know which ones had
engineered
toxins in them. I'd prefer not to eat those. And although I don't endorse food by McDonald's, and I certainly don't eat there myself, apparently Monsanto wouldn't have been able to push through the New Leaf genetically engineered potato without support from McDonald's in the early stages. Mm-hmm. But apparently after using the genetically engineered potato, McDonald's and several other large food companies responded to the public concern about genetically modified foods and supposedly stopped using genetically modified crops in their products.
So your fries at McDonald's are not genetically modified?
Not according to Michael Pollan.
Okay. That's good to know. You know, one concern I have too is that, you know, when Monsanto labels, in essence, this gene, they'll put some other genes along, like antibiotic resistance, along
That's
with
right.
the desired one.
That's to protect their patents. They're obviously very protective of genetically engineered plants, and they patent them so that farmers can't save the seeds and use them one year to year. They're only allowed one-year contracts with Monsanto seeds. They can't replant them or save the seeds. And if there is, you know, this transgenic pollination, like you had mentioned before, you can probably get sued by Monsanto even if you didn't plant their crops, in case somehow it other ends up in one of your fields.
What makes you wonder about eating a bunch of stuff that's antibiotic resistant and having that in your gut? Or what happens when the genes, as they've been now proven to do, leak out into the environment? Are we going to produce microorganisms on a whole, you know, wholesale basis that are resistant?
Yeah, that's a very good question.
I don't think anybody really has an answer to that.
I don't think so either.
Well, hopefully Dennis Kucinich and others can get them to spend, you know, maybe 3% of their budget on, you know, outcome possibilities to see if we can be protected from these things.
Yeah, I'd rather see them not used at all myself.
Yes, indeed. Well, Dr. Whitney Neiman, thanks so much for coming back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Michael Pollan's perhaps most interesting chapter is the one on marijuana. So
that is an interesting chapter.
Will you come back and talk about that?
I would love to.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to that.
Great.